Hello there, and welcome to Preprints in Motion, a podcast taking a deep dive in the fast-paced world of preprints.
Join us as we sit down with early career researchers, discuss their latest preprint, and find out about their journey through the muddy marshes of academia.
Hit that subscribe button, leave a rating, and find us on Twitter at MotionPod. Support us by heading over to buymeacoffee.com/preprints. But for now, let's get into the show.
This week it's all about preprint reviewing. We sit down with one of the first in the preprint reviewing arena, Pre-Review, to talk about why transparent peer review is important, how it helps bring equality, and its use as a teaching tool. I've been wanting to have you on for a while now, actually, and I've just been working. I've got a long list of people I want on. I've just been working through that slowly. So this is really exciting, and this is one of those ones we do where it's a bit of a different one. So we're not talking about science work. We're talking about the work of doing science and how we share it. And you're one of the best people to ask for about how we share science. So could you introduce yourself and give us a little bit of a background as to where you came from and where you now are?
Sure. I am Daniela Saderi. My pronouns are she, her, and I am originally, I was born and grew up in Sardinia, Italy, but I've been living in Portland, Oregon, in the United States for the past 10 years. So hence the accent. But I could have actually talked about science if you interviewed me now 5 years ago. So I have a background in neuroscience. So I came actually to the States for a PhD, to pursue a PhD in auditory neuroscience at Oregon Health and Science University, just here for my honeymoon. I was like, hey, can I come by and kind of check out your lab? And that's how we do it in Europe. And then we're like, oh, there is an actual application process. You have to study for all these things. So anyway, long story short, got in and then quickly realized that it was a bad decision because PhD programs don't have an end date in this country. So stayed in it for about 6 years. But I'm kind of someone that has a hard time kind of doing only one thing. And so about halfway through, I was starting to explore other things that I could be doing with my time. And I kind of stumbled into open science and learned about preprints from Jessica Polka, from Estelle Bayo, who I know you know very well, and started, I came back from HSU from a conference, OpenCon conference. It was amazing, mind-blowing. And said like, well, what can I do in my time as a researcher to kind of support this movement that really seemed to combine kind of my passion for activism that was kind of channeled more towards like political activism at the time and kind of combine it with like passion about science. And so started leading journal clubs. I was already leading journal clubs and I'm like, you know what? I'm doing all this extra work. We're going to start doing preprints instead of kind of trashing already published work and seeing who is the smartest in the room. So kind of also to try to change that narrative around feedback and kind of making it more constructive, like how can we actually help authors make it better at a point in time in which still maybe matter. So that's kind of like how I got into open science. And since 2019, when I graduated with my PhD, I have been full-time director of pre-review, working together with Monica Granados and Samantha Hindle, who have been kind of core leadership team for this whole time.
Jessica is one of my favorite people in science, just hands down. It's just amazing, which I say at every opportunity. So we're going to come back to the fact that you went straight from a PhD into directing, big step, but we'll stick with pre-review for now. So could you give us a little overview of how the pre-review system works and why it's different to, certainly at the time, what was around? Because there wasn't really anything, as far as I'm aware, that was like this around at the time.
Yeah, and it's interesting because it's not like nothing that we have done is like, oh, we have this clear vision. And I think, I don't know how many things actually are that way, but what we want. It was like, at the beginning was Sam and I, and then Monica joined in, but we were like, we just want to build some resources for other early career researchers who lead journal clubs around preprints. That was it. And it was like Google Docs and writing, you know, some things on Twitter with like a lot of paranoia because I wasn't on Twitter before this open science world threw me into it. But kind of tried to be very open about this. And we wrote like a small grant for Mozilla and said, like, we want some money to feed the people who are going to lead the journal clubs. Like, it was literally money for snacks. And we got this initial grant. That was our very first grant. And it basically, I think, one thing after the other kind of led us to think about, like, okay, yes, we don't want just recesses. Because it's like, at the time, as you said, there wasn't very much around reviews of preprints. It was still like really talking about the importance of preprints. And somehow I was also hearing like, we don't really want to put too much emphasis on the fact that preprints need feedback because their final manuscript, they're already, you know, there's very little change from, you know, people tend to publish the very last minute and when they submit to journals. But I actually, you know, I was convinced that A, there's always value for feedback because if we give feedback even to already published work that's been peer reviewed, then we find flaws everywhere or things that could be improved. But also, like, maybe this could be a way to improve values of publishing preprints sooner. And so pre-review today has gone through some iterations that we are iterating more of preprint review platforms for basically anyone who has an ORCID ID. So it's kind of the low barrier and of entry to review, provide constructive feedback to preprints. And what that means could be, we can talk at length about it. What is feedback? What is a review? But the reason why we actually decided to build a platform around it, like an online kind of tool to do it, is because, again, there was a comment in some preprint servers had comment box, some other didn't. But it wasn't just to make the kind of because the technology was missing, but more because we wanted to build kind of a sense of community with a set of strong core values that would kind of make someone feel like belong, like a sense of belonging to a specific group. And not just like, so the tool itself, yes, it's been the focus of our development at the beginning. It was what funders were interested in, but it was kind of an opportunity to try to also like have a space, an online space for resources, an online space for talking about what is that we're trying to do. And so the mission itself kind of shaped into being more around, we want to try to bring more transparency and openness to the peer review system via preprint. So there's a lack of training and preprints can help with that, and trying to do it as much as we can from an equity lens. So thinking about what are the missing pieces, what are the missing resources that some specific groups have been missing and are being kind of traditionally marginalized and excluded from the process. So that kind of, I think that online space is trying to give us that, or we thought it would give us that opportunity.
And that's the thing that makes this different from the ones. So, I mean, during COVID, we saw a bit of an explosion in sort of preprint review services, loads of them now. But the thing that makes yours still different and why I want to talk to you about this topic instead of any other people is that you have this community focus and you have, I mean, you run training programs, right? You have sort of ambassador programs where people can join and learn how to actually peer review and get some training. Because, you know, it'd be nice if universities offer this training, but when they don't, people have to come in and fill the gaps in. But the other thing is that you can break it down so that you don't actually have to do a full review of a preprint, you can just review the bits that you're an expert on.
Yeah, and this is something that there are so many, like, if you look at our like project management cards and things, there are so many parking lots, like ideas and features that I've been wanting to really do because I think that this is so important. Like this idea that a reviewer has to be an expert of everything that is in a paper, which doesn't exist. I mean, probably some people are like really good at that, but like what's, you know, and then this other idea of like, oh, a reviewer has this complete A to Z overview or review of everything that is in the paper. And in my experience as a researcher, I didn't get that. Like I actually, so the thing that made me think about features that would support this kind of more puzzle-like review is that I'm recorded on this. I may want to ask to delete this or not. I'm kidding. But one of the two papers that I published and that I published as my PhD had a Bayesian model statistics, and none of the authors in the team had like really great insights in Bayesian statistics. And a lot of research teams don't have statisticians on staff. So we asked like for a little bit of consulting, but it wasn't like, so I, when I submitted, I remember feeling like, oh, the reviewer is going to be all over this. Like, is it going to ask us a lot of questions? And reviewers came back and it's like nothing about the statistical model. And if that were wrong, the whole conclusion would have not been supported. So I'm like, that's not a minor thing. But they didn't ask anything because it was pretty obvious that the reviewers were chosen because of the model, the animal model, the behavior settings that we had. And so they were really more critical about those parts that they knew better. So if I had had the opportunity to say, hey, here's a preprint, which I actually put it out as a preprint, and I did still listen to feedback, but I really tap into a community of statisticians and say like, hey, you might not know anything about ferret auditory neuroscience integrated behavior, but you may see if this prior that I chose is okay. Like if this model actually makes sense in this context. And so I've, you know, always wanted to create a tool to support that, but that's not just about the tool. It's about the community that you make that then you can build trust with, and they trust you so that you can nudge them to do something that is not actually that rewarded. And just to go back to that super quick, and I think there is a lot to explore here in what I just said, I see your face, but also the aspect of the, you said, like, different kind of reviewers. So with the, during the COVID-19 pandemic, actually before the COVID-19 pandemic, in response to the Zika virus outbreak, Outbreak Science director at the time, oh my gosh, his name now is Michael Johansson. Thank you. I can do it. Michael Johansson, like, reached out to us, and we kind of wanted to get to this idea of a rapid review. So, like, how can we capture the essence of a preprint in, like, a rapid way so that we can allow for looking at, like, what are many, many reviews together look like? And so we have that rapid review now that we extended to every community, not just Outbreak Science. And this is, like, a series of yes or no questions. And that's also kind of imparting the response of, like, maybe someone wants to provide, like, a quicker feedback, but also how can we have this kind of shorter signals of quality and information around the preprint that can be used in other ways.
And this is the Outbreak Science.
Yeah, that which got combined in the end with Prairie, because I was at this, you know, then COVID came about and Michael was like, I'm working at the CDC, I don't have time for this. So I was like managing two different platforms with two different code bases. And I'm like, this is not okay. So we kind of joined the platform, and Outbreak Science is a community on Preview right now.
It's funny because when we had John and Richard on, I accused them of knowing the pandemic was coming because they started MedArchive months beforehand. And you seem to have done a similar thing. So I think some people could be forgiven for thinking, you know, the three of you got into a room together and maybe released COVID to the world. I think that's where it came from. I think we should stoke some conspiracy theorists.
I remember Michael was like, oh, there's an outbreak going on. It was like December. And, you know, CDC is pretty concerned. It's like December 2019. It's like, yep. I don't know. I cannot take credit for that vision.
So you said that sort of initial idea for previews come from these journal clubs, basically. Mm-hmm. I heard Pratyavasthi may have been involved. She's involved in everything. I thought I was busy and got around a lot, but she's everywhere. I don't know how she does it.
Me neither.
So how was she involved in this origin story?
Yeah, Fem and I, where we met, I think I was a host co-hosting like a Mozilla, what's called Mini Wow, like working open workshop here in Portland, Oregon. We called Sam because she was an ambassador for SF Bio, among other things that Sam was doing. She was still a postdoc at UCSF. She came by and we started talking about preprints and how much we liked, you know, SF Bio, and Sam was like, I'm an SF Bio ambassador. I'm like, I don't know what that is. And I became an ambassador. I go on my phone and like, oh, I signed up for being an ambassador. And so we kind of started, we actually wanted to do this with SF Bio. You know, we reached out, we were like, hey, I think it would be really, really cool if we did like a preprint journal club, you know, as ambassadors to, in order to try and provide review, more feedback to preprints. Would you like to, you know, talk about it and support it? And I think SF Bio at that time wasn't too much into preprint reviews. They are now. But <Yeah. laughs> but the thing is, like, so Prachi had actually, she was she joined us as like our early advisor, because we had chat with her and Jessica at the beginning, and she's like, yeah, I do this in my own lab, and I also, you know, I have some resources. I think she was using the Winnower maybe at the time. I don't remember what platform. And she was really important in understanding some of the needs that a journal club kind of organizer would need to have. She was very concerned for example, you mentioned training, like, but the identity of the trainees to be exposed, for, you know, there is this fear of like retribution, putting feedback, even if it's like constructively put, it can still be negative and kind of frankly piss people off. So she was very protective of that. And so I think that those initial conversations were really key in kind of shaping our idea around like identities of reviewers. And amongst a lot of other things, because Prachi is, as you said, like a generator of ideas.
Yeah, again, one of my favorite people in science. Yeah, I don't know how she does it.
Yeah, and she's a super mom too. I don't know.
I asked her, I don't think she really knows how she does it either. So the core mission here is to sort of increase diversity and equity in peer review. And by opening up there's a really good way of doing that, because obviously you get around that thing that a lot of editors do where they invite people based on status, not expertise necessarily. But how do you ensure that you stick to that mission of diversity? Because it's not necessarily an easy thing to do. It involves a very active role on your part. I guess this is possibly where the community aspect comes in more.
Yeah, so we have like a diversity, equity, and issues and inclusion statement that we try to update. And it is, we decided to make it our mission. So that could be, that's the focus. And it is, as any mission, so I think it is really difficult to kind of, when you have so many stakeholders and so many needs, to like keep the focus. But we really try to use that as guiding star. And it is further, you know, probably like even more difficult because it is such a complex aspect of, you know, of doing things. It's like, what do we mean by diversity? There are many dimensions. Who are we to really like say that we're establish ourselves as experts in any of this, right? Especially because we have limited small team and our identities are who we are. And I think that what we're trying to do is that everything we do, really, we try to kind of pass it through the lens of like, are we applying an equity lens? Are we really trying to prioritize issues of communities that have been traditionally marginalized? Who are those communities? Can we establish a partnership and a kind of opportunity-based and trust-based partnership? And those are all things that take a lot of time. And I initially was overwhelmed by this whole idea of even trying to do this. And I was like, we're totally going to screw up. And we probably are. But that's the point, like getting comfortable with the fact that we are going to make mistakes. It's not going to be perfect. But I think that what has been really rewarding in the past couple of years' work has been really cultivating and putting a lot of time and energy and resources into creating partnerships with organizations who are locally doing the work, who know those communities, because they are those communities. And so particularly, I want to highlight the work with Africa Archive, Training Center Communication Africa, a long established center of supporting researchers in Kenya and other regions in Africa, and Aider Africa, and more recently joined by eLife, but really trying to be like sat at a table for like hours and said like, what are you doing? What are the resources you already have? What are your values and goals? And is there any overlap that we have? And what can we do together? And really that idea of co-creation that the Center for Scientific Community Engagement has really put forward. Like, it's really hard, but I think it really is valuable work that can lead to can truly like not just saying, oh, this is the model we have and we developed in North America with this Italian, you know, white woman neuroscientist. And this other, you know, person, and we want you to adopt this model. Good luck. We want to try to figure out, does this work for you? And also, like, here it is. Make it whatever. How can we help you support and adapt it to the needs? I think that's the most exciting work for me. And I want to, we recently got some funding, which I can't talk about because we haven't kind of announced it yet. But I'm also very excited because we are hiring for a community manager who I hope will really focus their work on developing more of these partnership and really opportunities to contribute to other needs that we don't even know that exist.
I mean, that was kind of a selfish question, because one of the core values we had when we set this up was to try and make sure we're as diverse as we can be, because the whole point of this podcast is to highlight early career researchers. That group is already not heard much, or certainly not heard enough in science. So we thought, and that's the group where everyone is still there. Sadly, everything drops off as soon as you get past that group. So it's the perfect group, we thought, to do that. And I think we're not doing amazingly in it, but I think our gender split is almost 50-50. In fact, I think we've switched it to more women on the show now. But otherwise, I think that's one of the things we kind of struggle with, because it's not necessarily an easy thing to do.
Yeah, and you go, diversity is just like really step one. So it is, and it's such a complex thing. So we had a whole like a set of resources set aside for consulting. We continue to question our approaches and ourselves. And it's just a continuum and a growth that leads. What we know is that we don't like what's right now. Yeah. And there is also this idea that, you know, open science is going to change everything. And I really like all the work that Dr. Leslie Chen and Dr. Angelo Kuhne and others at the project that is now sunsetted, but is still there in the OSCDNet. But basically, really questioning also the idea of open science and open scholarship as a solution to everything, because changing things in a system that is problematic without considering all the legacy of the oppression system that have made it up in the first place, just going to reproduce everything in the same way and label it as open. So I really love the discussion and trying to read more about feminist approaches and kind of how can we truly redo it better. And one of the frustrating things I think in scholarship and academia is this idea that you touched on of prestige. And it's a quick label, right? Oh, that person must be an expert because I recognize the name. They are at Harvard. They have 3 out of 1s. And it's just like all this proxy for prestige, especially for as reviewers. It doesn't mean they're going to be good reviewers. And so we really, with our training, trying to question that, a lot of that stuff, and also understand what is the legacy of each system of oppression we can think of, and how does it show up in the process of reviewing.
I think diversity has probably been the biggest casualty of the really cool stuff that's happening in open science, because the journals have all responded, the publishers have responded basically by switching who pays. So now instead of universities and these big corporations paying, it's the authors who have to pay to publish. Mm-hmm. And if you're anywhere that isn't part of the Western world, that's not an easy thing to do. Even if you are part of the Western world, the work I did, I couldn't get any money to publish it. We had a collaborator. Thanks, Liam. He listens. who was able to provide the funds for the first paper. And then some amazing folks in the US saw our preprint and we submitted together and they paid for the second one. So, you know, that's been the kind of undertone that isn't talked about enough, I don't think.
It's just a business model that makes no sense. And until you question it, it's kind of like, I remember that awakening at OpenCon. I was like, wait a second, I didn't think that about that. Like, we pay for everything. We pay for publishing, rereading it. We pay, like, that makes no sense. And I remember one of the training we did was to a group of undergraduates. So, you know, they're not really into accustomed to the system. And a question we got was like, so how much do you get paid to publish in Nature? And I'm like, that is brilliant. No, you pay $10,000, my dear.
Yeah, we pay a third of my yearly salary to publish in Nature, right? How much we pay. Yeah, it's insane. We're currently writing a documentary about the history of scientific publishing. And the whole thing is based on the shadiest man imaginable. And it's just, it's remarkable. It's going to be really good when we eventually do it.
I can't wait for you to read that, because we start our training with some of that stuff. But I love someone who did some more research.
We're working on it. We've done all the research. I just need to sit down and write it. It'll get there. I'm going on a total tangent here. I'm gonna give you an actual question. We're prepared to get back on track. Coming back to that notion of the issues with peer review and why we need to be more transparent, I think a lot of the listeners will be aware, because I basically don't show up about the issues in science, peer review being one of them. But could you just go through and kind of highlight some of the biggest issues why not being transparent in peer review is actually a problem? It might help someone else says these things, because nobody listens to me.
And this is like, I think that there are some aspects that are straightforward. Like when I first got into open science and thinking about this, the specific peer review from an open perspective, it seems like, oh, the solution, and I think a lot of people were thinking about that, is like, open is best. It's always better to be transparent and open. I remember giving a talk, one of our first funders, we were funded by Sloan, but this one I think was the Wellcome Trust. And I was presenting some of the ideas around, you know, that the platform is, the reviews are all going to be open, licensed CC BY 4.0. So with attribution, get a DOI for citation, and like also trying to kind of improve on recognition of the contribution to scholarly publication in that way, with a hope that the funder would say, oh, we'll actually take that in consideration. But I specifically remember when I got to think to talk about identities, and I have this conversation now almost every week. It's like, we need to be transparent about everything. And I want to know who the reviewer is, because otherwise, how am I going to be able to evaluate the review? And that is like, I'm like, well, you just caught yourself. Can you repeat that and listen to what you just said? But the idea was like, oh, you know, someone raised their hand, and I'm not going to make names, but it was a big name. And said, like, I think that's not going to be okay, because in the name, you know, we're trying here to promote transparency, and we should, you know, I would have no problem putting my name on my comment. I'm like, really? You're one of the most powerful men that I know. Yes, you would have no problem. I guess you wouldn't. But the whole idea of open and transparency is like just a blanket policy that's going to be on everything. It's just very kind of problematic. And I still think that I need to talk to more people to understand how deep that goes. And I think that transparency is always better to opaqueness, right? And one of the issues with the peer review, when we kind of presented at the beginning of like, what are the main issues of peer review right now, is like lack of training, but really like the fact that it is this black box that nobody really, you know, knows how to crack. And specifically if you're a researcher, you just submit to the who knows, you don't know what, how long it's going to take, who is going to look at it. And you have this fear, obviously, of the reviewers coming, the review come back and making you work for another year and a half or rejecting. Like, it is such an emotional process, and not knowing what's happening contributes to that anxiety. And so I in that perspective, I think that transparency, especially like, you know, having the option to write your name, but it is and publish the report, those are all very good things. But I still don't believe, for example, that forcing a policy where the names of the reviewer have to be there is a good one, and particularly because we are trying to include communities that have been traditionally marginalized, that have been traditionally told that they're not experts, they're not believed as being experts, even if they've proven over and over to be experts. So that is going to cause. And so just ignoring and saying like, oh, equality for everybody, we're all going to have the same things, it just doesn't work because there is no equality. So I think that even in developing these solutions, we really need to think about how can we make it possible for everybody to truly participate at the same level. And that means that others, some are going to need different approaches. And the last thing I want to say about this is that we were invited to it was like a workshop at the Triangle of Science. This was pre-pandemic. And I submitted a proposal all around like exploring preprint reviews and how can we, you know, improve this process and adoption. And I invited a group of folks that I knew and researchers from different organizations and parts of the world. And the entire focus of the workshop shifted to being like kind of questioning this approach to like openness of everything, and even preprints as like the best tool. And so someone was there saying like, well, you want me to post a preprint, but I am in this small research group in Ghana working on malaria. And the biggest, I would say, like rival or, you know, the other group that works on the specific things is at Harvard with 30 postdocs. So the advantages that I have is that I'm local. I have a lot of data and that our case is here. And so they're like, if you want me to put a preprint with all my data out, like my name is not famous in the space. And so there is this fear. And so I think that even for preprints, we need to explore more of these ideas of like using technology to also try to get that early, to give access to that early feedback and to the possibility of publishing, but maybe in a more controlled way. And I don't know exactly what the solutions are for feedback. There was also another issue brought up as an equity gap, which is like, if I'm in a small group, in a small lab, I don't have access to the expertise, the daily expertise that someone else would have access to in a bigger, more resourceful institution. And so actually getting that early feedback from the global community would be wonderful, but I want to do it in a way that is not by publishing it to everybody to see, but maybe in a controlled, trusted space. And so there is that also in the back of my mind, like, how can we support this, like, trusted communities that can slowly grow, and what is that measure of trust?
I mean, that's kind of, I think the pandemic's been a really good example of why some of those things, or showing some of those things. So there was the case of, not name them, but a Nobel Prize winner who took to Twitter to very publicly attack a PhD student who critiqued his work. And that, I think, until we level out science and we get rid of that status and really weird hierarchy, there's a lot of worship goes on in science, and I just don't understand it. But I think until we get rid of that and we do make it more of a level playing field, I think that's, those issues are always going to be there, because the people who are most at risk from having their name associated with a peer review are the early career researchers, or people from countries where they're in small labs or they haven't got money, or women, or anyone who isn't a white middle-class man, basically. And I think, yeah, I think we really do need to break that down a bit to even begin to help with that. But that really nicely brings us into community. So you went from PhD to essentially running a community. Community manager is one of those roles I've certainly noticed a lot more in academia in the past few years. It's been coming up a lot more lately. So you've got things like Prelight, ASAP Bio have the community, you've got a community, Arcadia have a community manager, and some of the journals have community managers as well. Why do you think we're seeing that increase? Actually, that's a question. But also, could you just talk about what it's like to run a community? Because it's not easy. I kind of do it myself, and I also talk about it a lot, and it's difficult.
Yeah, I'm definitely not a community manager in that sense. So let's see. So kind of going from my experience, because I became full-time after 1 week that I graduated, I had a Mozilla fellowship to support me for the first year, and then some funding that we got along the way. I was the only person full-time until very recently when we hired someone for a specific program. And then now we're hiring a community manager because I had to wear just too many hats. And I think that one of community managers is always that one that would make me feel like a failure.
Join the club.
Because it's just like, I don't think we have a community. I mean, we have a community, and I've taken the community fundamentals with the Lou Woodley and the Center for Scientific Community Engagement. And I remember all the exercises were like, who is your community? How many people are in your community? And I was like panicking. I was like, I don't know. Like, I'm not tracking very well. I wanted to have a newsletter for years that I just haven't had the time. And so I think it's a key role. Like, a lot of the funding that we got at the beginning were very focused on software. And we still get that a lot of funders want software. And you put a line budget that is like high, or, you know, and not high, what you need for community engagement. They're like, wait a second, what is this? And I'm like, well, this is what you need to get people on your tool. And this is what you need to change culture. You need at least two people, you know, like me and another person. I think it's not going to be enough. But so to answer the other question about like, why do we see an increase in community management, is because I think that our role has always been there, but not recognized, right? So that was one of the mission of the CSCCE, which is like professionalize this work. And with a lot of like skills that were seen as soft skills that are not very useful. But then if that person suddenly went on maternity leave, parental leave, let's say, then you would see the lack of the work. And that is not great. So I still think that there is a long road to make that role paid more. We try to have like a really nice salary. We got amazing applications from people who have actual experience in community management, which I was, oh my gosh, it was so great. But it is a key role for everything, because it's like, if you don't have, and there is, you know, we're competing with so many distractions, that like really thinking about what is the value of what we are doing and how is that designed in response to the needs of people, and like, is there even a need? Because sometimes that's the hardest part for me, is like, I really am locked to that idea. And then I want someone, the community manager, we are hiring also for a product manager that is going to be very community oriented, to say like, actually, that idea is not tested. We can test it. And then if still is up, but like, or is something with the community wants, then we can do it. And not just because you like it, Daniela. I'm very excited about that.
So how did you find that step from going straight from your PhD into doing a job that involves you basically doing everything?
With anxiety. That I didn't think that. I always said, like, I'm not an anxious person. And I started having chest pain.
And, you know, because most of us go on to do a postdoc, and it's not much different.
I almost did. And I actually almost got two postdocs interview offers because I was reviewing the manuscript of these people, and they came to SFN and my poster, and they were like, thank you for your reviews. And that was also a motivator for me. I'm like, I want these early credit researchers to get this opportunity. But and one of these offer was like, and I was like, look, I just want to do this for a while. And they were like, yeah, you can do 50-50. And, you know, it's going to be okay. You can do a postdoc that, you know, involves brain surgeries of macaque monkeys, and also be director of pre-review. And I'm like, as appealing as it sounds, probably not. So I think it was very difficult. And what really, really helped me was getting a leadership coach, that I paid way too much money at the beginning, but then I was able to get in to this program. It's like a, what's the name? It's a leadership coaching program only for women. TC, I forgot the name, but I still support it and I still donated to it because it's basically an opportunity to get a leadership coach at very cheap, relatively cheap amount of money. And that really helped because it was basically a therapist with a plus, like understanding that what I was doing was very new to me and I wasn't trained, but also that I was doing it and I needed to step up as a leader, especially the hardest stuff was contractors at the beginning in the development space and software, because that's completely outside of my knowledge. And so I would feel like played out a little bit at the beginning. And so then feeling like, oh my gosh, I'm wasting money. I'm not doing it well. And it's still there. It's still a process. And I think I should go back to coaching because I'm missing it.
I mean, that sounds great. I just do things and make up as I go. And we see how it works out, really. I think what I'm trying to do is model myself after a much, much less successful Pratchy. That's what I seem to be doing. So she's done it. I'm basically going to do it at some point soon. Just not nearly as well. Just something I wanted to touch on, because following on from that, I do a lot of things myself. I've got, my last count, I had 18 different projects. Lab projects, not lab projects. Like, we can't do the podcast as a project.
You should never count. Why are you counting?
I needed to. So I think I needed a list for something. I can't remember why. Too many. This started as essentially a side project for you. And I always say, where you can, you should take them on, because I benefit a lot from, I benefit more from the side project I do than I ever have from my lab work so far, to be honest. Maybe that stays where I put all my energy. How do you find balancing doing stuff out of the lab with doing stuff in the lab? That's still kind of, it's a job. Like, this is, for us, this is a hobby, but it's also kind of a job.
Yeah, that's why I abandoned the lab. But I did it. I did it for a year and a half when I was still a PhD student. And, you know, you're writing a thesis in the meantime. And it was, and I had the Mozilla Fellowship that supported my, so I gave up my NIH grant. And my boss was like, what? And I'm like, yes, but I got a Mozilla Fellowship. It pays like 3 times as much. So, ha! But, and also, he's, you know, I was almost done with experiments. So that worked out. I was traveling a lot and writing my thesis. And I think that I would have never been able to do it if I haven't had the support of my PI. And I don't know if that was kind of a quiet. I'm sure he was frustrated. Hi, Stephen. Thank you. But also kind of, I don't know, maybe partially it's because it's hard for me. I didn't ask. I was like, this is happening. I got the Mozilla Fellowship. So I'm graduating. Bye. I don't know. I think it would have been really, really hard to balance. Right now, for me, the balance is just like, I struggle with finding time to strategize. And so I'm feeling like I'm playing whack-a-mole every day. I'm like, fire, put it down. Oh, then I fire here. And so I'm like reactive constantly. And the time that I need to, that I actually sit down and think is when I have to write a grant. But then I have to do the grant because to start, you know, the clock starts ticking, and so it feels very reactive. And I really hope that there was two new people that join, it can be a little bit less so. And I also have to say the support of people. We got so many good advisors and kind of sending emails and say, like, please, I have this question. I've always been very direct. If you have time, great. If you don't, that's fine. Now we have actually time to, you know, money to pay for some of the compensation for the time we offered it, people turned it down. And the team, like Sam and Monica, this is the kind of the last thing that I want to say. It's like, without Sam and Monica, this would have not gone anywhere, because it was very difficult at the beginning. We all had this as a side project. And then suddenly I stepped up as full-time director, not knowing even what that meant. It was a lot of like, oh, now we need to trust Daniela to take decisions. We cannot like go through all her decisions. And so there was a lot of tension at the beginning. And we probably could have abandoned everything because of those kind of difficulties that we were going through personally, just communication. And then we were like, you know what? Sam and I were doing leadership coaching on our own. And my leadership coach is like, I think you need like a team leadership coach that can come and help you out. And this person, Didi Pro Bono, came to another conversation with three of us. I think it was 2 hours. And I swear there was a switch that I just like, we dream about being with one another. Like, I don't know what happened during those 2 hours, but that woman just, because we all wanted to be there. We all wanted to make this work. And the way that we work together now is amazing. So I cannot recommend more personal leadership coach and also like team dynamics. So I think that that moral support of having someone else there that really cares, it is still key.
No, I relate with that feeling of almost panic of just, you feel like you're constantly putting fires out on different things. I constantly feel like I'm just failing at everything because I'm split across too many things and it feels like I don't do any one thing well.
Oh, totally.
So that would have been a good ending point. But last question, what's the best way for people listening to get involved with pre-review?
Oh my goodness. So yes, our community manager will make all of this more streamlined, but I think that, so we don't have a volunteer program right now because I just never felt I had the time to properly value volunteers rather than saying like, hey, can you do this for free for me? But I think, you know, definitely like, I know it's horrible, but like email contact@prereview.org, just checking out the website, prereview.org/reviews. You do find the platform. So if you do want to try out, like, and see if you want to review even just rapidly and answer a bunch of yes or no questions to a preprint that you recently read, you can do it. You just need an ORCID ID. In terms of community engagement, we have a Slack channel. And I think so if you go on pre-review about page, there should be links to join. But this is the thing, like, I don't have a lot of easy mechanisms for people to just join in a community that is beyond like making an account and starting reviewing and contacting us. We receive emails from people that say like, hey, I love what you're doing, how can we help? And I want to create a path for that work to happen with meaning and to really provide opportunities for the people I want to help, even as volunteers, so that their work doesn't feel just like I'm giving you my free time and I don't get back anything.
Well, there you go. And all those links will be in our show notes so people can get to them right now because we're about to finish.
Where do I find out about the different bioarchive licenses? This CC, BY, CDXY nonsense is driving me nuts.
ASAP Bio have a resource for that.
Ugh, that's your answer to everything.
That's because they have everything you need to know about preprints.
Sure, they probably have the basics, like info on the preprint servers, but what else is there?
There's so much more. Looking to post a preprint, but not sure what different journal policies are? They have a collection to help you out with that. There are meetings around preprints and associated services. If you want to know how preprint adoption has changed over time, there's even a page on that.
And COVID?
They have a big section on preprints and the pandemic, plus some really cool infographics for communicating preprints.
And university policies? Surely they don't have that.
They collect uni policies where possible.
Okay, they do sound pretty impressive, but is it not a bit of an echo chamber?
It can be, but ASAP Bio also engage with people who don't love preprints and have concerns. So we had an excellent discussion on this very topic a couple of months ago.
Oh, is there anything ASAP Bio don't do?
Honestly, no, they're so nice over there. They were so quick to jump in and support this show. It's your one-stop shop for info on preprints and open science initiatives. So head over to asapbio.org to learn more and subscribe to their newsletter for the latest in preprint news. If you want a deeper dive into the world of preprints, then look out for the next recruitment of ASAP Bio Fellows.
And that's the show, folks. If you enjoyed listening, then hit that subscribe button to get the latest updates straight to wherever it is you're listening. Don't forget to rate us on Spotify or Apple and follow us on Twitter at MotionPod. You can find links to things we've just discussed on our website, preprintsandmotion.com. If you'd like to tell us what you think, then send an email, shout at us on Twitter, or shout at us if you see us walking down the street. This has been a JMJ production, generously supported by our friends at ASAP Bio. Until next time, have a good week.